The top political donor of 2016 wants to elect leaders who will fight climate change. Fun fact, he made a lot of his own money from carbon-polluting fossil fuels.
And I changed my behavior because I realized, wow, this is a big problem that's not getting solved.
I'm Carol Holzapfel. This week on the Allegheny Front, we talk to the billionaire some are calling the liberal Koch brother. Plus, we look at the financial ties some candidates have to the oil and gas industry. And coal. Don't forget coal. And to blow off a little of that political steam, we go to Pennsylvania elk country. That's all coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. Pennsylvania's U.S. Senate race is shaping up to be one of the most closely watched nationwide and one of the most expensive. The contest between incumbent Republican Pat Toomey and his Democratic challenger Katie McGinty could decide which party controls the Senate. And as State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips reports, it's also become a national battle between fossil fuel interests and environmentalists.
Millions of dollars are pouring into the state from both big oil and big green. On the Republican side, oil and gas money is backing Pat Toomey. And on the Democratic side, environmental groups are backing Katie McGinty. And if you watch television, you're getting bombarded with attack ads like this.
The rest of us. That's why Toomey voted to give big oil polluters $24 billion in tax breaks. No wonder big oil polluters have given Toomey $700,000 in contributions. Pat Toomey's
the ad, by the way, is paid for by the environmental group League of Conservation Voters, which, along with groups like Next Gen Climate Action, Environmental Defense Action Fund, and Environment America, has poured nearly $4 million into an effort to elect Democrat Katie McGinty. That $700,000 referred to in the ad are oil and gas industry contributions to Republican Pat Toomey, as calculated by OpenSecrets.org, which tracks campaign funds reported to the Federal Election Commission. Open Secrets also reports that a super PAC associated with the conservative oil-rich Koch brothers has spent $7.2 million to help elect Toomey. As for oil and gas-funded attacks against McGinty, there's plenty of those as well. This ad is paid for by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which has spent about $5.6 million to elect Toomey.
What, energy?
Yes. Have you seen how Katie McGinty tries to tax energy? Proposed $72 billion in BTU taxes under Clinton, as much as $1.8 billion in taxes on Pennsylvania energy. She even supported cap and trade.
That ad refers to McGinty's support for a carbon tax when she worked for Bill Clinton's administration. Carbon taxes are aimed at reducing greenhouse gas emissions. When it comes to the nation's future on energy production, environmental protection, and climate change, a lot rides on which party controls the U.S. Senate. So even if these are not the top issues for Pennsylvania voters, you can bet they are for the fossil fuel industry fighting new environmental regulations, as well as environmentalists racing to put a halt to a warming planet. For large national environmental groups, backing McGinty is a no-brainer. She was a protege of Al Gore. She served as Pennsylvania's Environmental Protection Secretary, and she is committed to fighting climate change. Toomey, on the other hand, is a big supporter of continuing coal production, as well as oil and gas. He's critical of McGinty's support for Obama's Clean Power Plan, an effort to make electric power plants cleaner, which Republican Senator Pat Toomey says is an attack on the coal industry. Here's Toomey speaking to the Pennsylvania Press Club last month.
The EPA is determined to end the coal industry. Hillary Clinton is a cheerleader for that. So is Katie McGinty. By the way, natural gas is next.
But it seems unlikely McGinty will go after natural gas. She doesn't support a fracking ban. Instead, she says it should be regulated. And McGinty served on the board of NRG, an energy company with natural gas interests. McGinty did promote renewable energy development under former Governor Ed Rendell. She told the Pennsylvania Press Club back in August that she's not against coal, but she spent most of her time talking about incentives for solar and wind.
I would lead the charge to make sure we have those incentives in place and we can get back to those good manufacturing jobs, those good clean energy jobs that we were proud to have when I was serving as Secretary of Environmental Protection.
The money that oil and gas interests are spending for Pat Toomey far outweighs the environmental dollars spent on Katie McGinty. But between now and Election Day, a national proxy war over energy and environment will continue to be waged here in the Pennsylvania Senate race. Susan Phillips, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
So as we just heard, big bucks are flooding into political campaigns this year. And one billionaire donor is using his dollars to push for action on climate change. Tom Steyer is a retired hedge fund manager from California who runs Next Gen Climate, the political action group he founded. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier spoke with Steyer when he was in Pittsburgh recently. And Reed joins me now. Reed, just how much money are we talking about here?
It's a lot, Kara. So this year, Steyer has given close to $40 million to climate-friendly candidates around the country, including more than $400,000 here in Pennsylvania to help Democratic Senate candidate Katie McGinty.
And as we learned in Susan Phillips' story, Steyer is going head-to-head with the Koch brothers, the conservative billionaires, right?
Yeah, that's right. So one of the groups helping McGinty's opponent, Pat Toomey, is funded by the Koch brothers, and they've poured millions into Senate races across the country. In fact, some people have called Tom Steyer the liberal version of the Koch brothers. And I asked him about that to see if he thought that was a fair comparison. Here's what he said.
I don't think so at all. What they're doing, whether it's explicitly for their bottom line interests or just happens to line up with their bottom line interests, the fact of the matter is what we're doing is something about what our deepest values in terms of what we think is good for the country. There's no way to show that it in any way, shape, or form helps anybody's bottom line who works at Next Gen Climate, because it doesn't. That's the first point. Second point is we really believe in transparency. We think there's a huge problem with money in politics. Then one way to mitigate that problem is transparency, to say what you're doing, to be straightforward, to be on this radio show talking to you and explaining what you're doing, but also to make sure that you report everything to the government so that people can see what you're doing. And that's something that they just don't do. They work, you know, as secretly and quietly as possible, trying to hide what they're doing, trying to prevent people from knowing who they are and who they're supporting and why. So I think that, and the last thing I'd say is this, you know, I actually quit my job 4 years ago to do this full time because I thought there was such a big problem that needed to be addressed. You know, whatever else you can say, those guys still are full-time business people who have a political agenda of their own that they pursue.
So I did want to ask you about what you did before you quit your job.
Mm-hmm.
You've been criticized, you know this, for having investments in fossil fuel industries, including coal. Now you're basically trying to work against those industries if they are adding to the climate change problem. You know, people have called you hypocritical for doing that.
Mm-hmm.
How do you see it?
I think that if you get new information, you change your behavior. So from my standpoint, we invested in everything, every business. Energy is a huge part of American business or worldwide business. And we invested in it somewhat proportionally or maybe less around the world. And then I started to get really concerned about this. And I changed my behavior. I divested from anything having to do with fossil fuels. And I started to work because I realized, wow, this is a big problem that's not getting solved. I mean, I think everybody, including me, knew there was a problem, but I expected the American political system to solve it. As it kept not getting solved, I started to get more involved and to try and examine both what is the problem and why isn't it getting solved. And as I did, I stopped investing in those. I sold any investments I had related to fossil fuels. So from my standpoint, if you get new information and act on it and then proceed on that way, is that somehow a conflict of interest or talking out of both sides of your mouth? I think that's ridiculous. What I'm asking everyone in the United States to do is exactly what I did, which is to look at the evidence to see, wow, there's some new information here that we need to change our behavior based on and to change our behavior based on it.
Was there one thing that kind of pushed you in this direction?
Well, what really happened was sometime about 10 years ago, I was struggling with what was going to be the biggest threat to the country. I don't know why I was thinking about it, but I somehow got obsessed with that question. And so I really looked at it.
And I thought, wow, this is obviously it. And I tried, and I started to think about what is there, what can I possibly do that would help? And I started by just trying to fund some technological research, like maybe this is a tech problem. And so if I give some money to some scientists to come up with some technological fixes, that's how it will work. And so I got involved starting that way. And then, you know, gradually got more involved in terms of thinking, wow, why isn't this being solved in the normal American way? If we have a problem, we may scream and yell. Americans are famously loud and contentious, but we face up to our problems and we deal with them together. We figure out solutions. Maybe they're compromises, but we deal with solutions and we move on. We've done that for several hundred years. The question was, why wasn't that happening here?
And in your mind, why wasn't it happening?
It was to no one's advantage to solve this. The biggest industry in the country that made hundreds of billions of dollars of profits every year was dependent on the status quo staying the status quo. And they were going to do whatever they could to make sure that that was what happened. That's what the Koch brothers are. We want the status quo. We want to keep running the country exactly the same way because it is super profitable for us. And there was nobody on the other side saying, oh, there are new industries we can create. We have the technology to solve this. We need to solve it. And so I felt like, wow, someone has to do that. And, you know, maybe I can be part of that solution.
The fossil fuel industry, at least in this state, can sort of paint you as a kind of a type. You come in from the outside. You're from the coast. You have a lot of money, and you're pushing an agenda that could cost some people who work in the state, you know, their jobs if they work in a coal mine or some kind of other fossil fuel industry. How do you respond to that?
People like to frame clean energy as we're opposed to fossil fuels. The fact of the matter is we have a huge infrastructure project in the United States to rebuild our energy infrastructure in a way that will create millions of net jobs. So the fact of the matter is that what we will do will make America richer. It will make its citizens better off and take home more money. It will produce net a couple million new jobs. So it will actually, and it will save us money. So the fact of the matter is on a gross basis, it's a plus all the way around. The problem is, and it actually is a real problem, is there's a transition there. You know, part of the way the capitalism works is new ideas come in and they destroy old ideas. And when they destroy old ideas, they destroy the industries that supported those old ideas. And that means that jobs are destroyed. And that is bad. And in the United States of America, it's really important that as that happens, we recognize it happens and protect the people who went to work in those industries just to have a decent wage and support their families, who've done nothing wrong except go to work and try and do their job. The fact of the matter is, on a gross basis, this is much better for the United States, and we also have to do it. If you look at the projections, if we do nothing for this century, which is a long time, it will destroy 36% of our GDP. That's the analysis. This is not a one-off. That's where we're going. Come to California and see what it costs in California not to have any snowpack. This is not something that's going to happen. It's happening.
That was the Allegheny Friends Reed Frazier speaking with Tom Steyer, founder of Next Gen Climate. Thanks, Reed.
No problem, Kara. And you can hear an extended version of this interview at AlleghenyFront.org.
We asked to interview the Koch brothers, Charles and David, but they declined. A spokesperson for their political action group, Freedom Partners Action Fund, said it gives to candidates who will, quote, work for a free and open society, and said the group lists all donors as per federal election laws. Later in the show, we have more political coverage, this time from West Virginia's coal country. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. The Allegheny Front is part of I See Change, an online climate and weather almanac where people across the country post observations about what's going on outside. And people have been noticing some weird things about the leaves on the trees where they live. Observers in Wisconsin and Michigan noticed leaves turning brown in summer. In Kansas, someone reported elm trees changing color in September. So what's going on with the leaves here? We called someone who would know.
My name is Rachel Mahoney, and I'm the Environmental Education Specialist at Forbes State Forest.
That's in the Laurel Highlands in southwestern Pennsylvania. Mahoney keeps a weather and nature journal to help her predict when we'll reach peak leaf splendor.
Judging by the fact that we had kind of drought-like conditions throughout most of the growing season, I could kind of presume that that would delay the peak foliage.
The leaves have already gone red, orange, and yellow in much of the higher elevations of northern Pennsylvania. But Mahoney says this weekend through next week is when leaves will pop in the southwest. And according to the Department of Conservation and Natural Resources leaf map, that's true for central Pennsylvania, too. It's about a week later than some years.
The black gums are usually the first tree that begin to turn, and those are almost at peak, and they're already starting to drop leaves. But a lot of the maples are still developing their color, and there's still a good bit of green up top.
Some of those pigments that make brilliant red hues are created by sugars in the leaves, activated by sunny fall days and cool nights, the kind of weather we've been having lately. But the dry winter and summer drought stunned a lot of trees. Some dropped their leaves while they were still green, or their leaves became splotchy. Mahoney says she's seen a bit more of that than is typical. And there's another bummer for fall leaves caused by drought.
The colors tend to be a little bit duller.
But Mahoney says from what she's seen so far, leaf peeping should still be pretty sweet this year. So what have you noticed about leaves or trees or the weather? Join the conversation at iSeeChange. That's iSeeChange.org. Or download the app and help us tell our region's climate and weather stories. We heard earlier about the contentious U.S. Senate race in Pennsylvania. Now let's move to West Virginia's gubernatorial race. Billionaire coal operator and candidate Jim Justice's companies owe more than $12 million in county, state, and federal taxes. That's according to a review of records by NPR and the Ohio Valley Resource. Justice's companies also owe over $2 million in delinquent fines for mine safety violations, the most of any coal operator in the country, and have left mine lands in dangerous condition. Benny Becker of Ohio Valley Resource reports from Eastern Kentucky, where officials and residents are dealing with the debts and damaged land that Justice has left behind.
Jim Justice is West Virginia's Democratic candidate for governor. And according to Forbes, he's also the wealthiest person in the state. Here's how he describes himself in a recent TV ad.
I'm a businessman, not a politician. I'm a coal man.
Justice has taken criticism for his business practices and for failing to pay his bills. Back in April, the Charleston Gazette-Mail reported that Jim Justice owed at least $3.9 million in overdue property taxes to six West Virginia counties. Justice quickly committed to paying off all of those taxes.
Every single tax obligation that I have in West Virginia will be paid before the end of the month of April.
That month, Justice did pay down a lot of the property taxes he owed to counties in West Virginia. But the review of records by NPR and The Resource found his payments covered only a fraction of the back taxes that he owes. He still owes $3.7 million in West Virginia state taxes, all from before the promise he made in April. Justice's companies also owe more than $3 million in overdue federal taxes. And Justice also owes large amounts of taxes to counties outside West Virginia, mostly in an area that has some of the country's highest poverty rates and could really use the money.
All of Eastern Kentucky is in a financial crisis.
That's Zach Weinberg, the top elected official in Knott County, Kentucky. His county has been among the hardest hit by the coal industry's recent struggles and the shrinking tax base that goes with it.
We used to have a $20 million budget in the heyday of 09 and 10. It's a $10 million budget now.
And it's not just taxes. Justice's companies are more than $2 million behind in paying mine safety fines, and they've also been cited for environmental problems. Justice recently agreed to a nearly $6 million settlement with state and federal agencies for water pollution violations. And in Kentucky, state officials took Justice to court for failing to restore his company's mine lands. There's been steady progress since then, but Justice's companies still have a lot more reclamation work to do, and some unreclaimed mines have already caused serious damage. Bevins Branch is a Justice-owned surface mine in Pike County, Kentucky. The deadline for reclaiming the mine was July 2015, but little had been done by the night of June 3, 2016, when a heavy rain fell on the abandoned mine site and turned this little stream you're hearing into a flood of debris.
It was a total disaster.
It was like a bomb went off. A 2-minute period, all you could see was a wall of water, rock, trees, dirt, and everything that washed from the mine site.
That's Molly Smith and Chad Keene. Their road was washed away, so the couple and all of their neighbors up the road had no way out.
We were stuck up here. The water still hadn't went down at daylight.
Keene and Smith told me they were really unhappy with how the company responded.
The mines at first denied that they had any wrongdoing. I said, well, it don't rain rocks and trees and that much dirt from the sky.
There was a second stream of mud and debris rushing down the mountain that night. Laura and Elvis Thacker say it flooded their property just 10 minutes after the rain started.
The water came so fast that our cats drowned.
Up underneath, it knocked blocks and stuff out, and it's molded the whole inside the house. It seeped through the walls. It was $148,000 worth of damage.
The Thackers told me that Justice's company had offered them some money, but not nearly enough to get back to the stable situation they'd been working toward for years.
He lost a coal job 7 years ago. After that, we lost his truck,
we
lost my Kia.
Keep everything we got.
I worked two jobs, he worked two jobs. We just recently got to where we only had to work one apiece. We've lost everything, and we're going to have to start all over.
The couple is now talking to a lawyer, trying to get Justice and his company to take responsibility and pay for the damage. The company fixed the ditch that breached about a month after the flood, but there is still outstanding reclamation issues on that mine site, and it's still a cause for concern.
We don't sleep when it rains. If it's raining, we make sure that somebody's awake all the time just in case that happens again.
You always worry when the next one's going to break, and you always just live in fear.
Jim Justice and his team didn't respond to our interview requests, but here's how Justice defended the delays during a primary debate back in April.
Jim Justice has never bankrupted any company. It would have been an easy way. Just shut the doors. Let everybody get stuck. I didn't do it. I promise you that every single obligation that I ever have will be fulfilled.
Back in Knott County, I asked Judge Weinberg what he thought about that defense.
If they eventually pay it, that's probably true. If they don't pay it, it's not better at all. We know that he could pay it one way or the other.
After NPR and The Resource asked Justice for comment, his companies began making payments on several of their long overdue tax bills, including in Knott County. It's a start, but there's still a lot of money owed, and in many cases, damage has already been done. I'm Benny Becker in Knott County, Kentucky.
That story comes to us by way of Ohio Valley Resource, a public media partnership from Kentucky, West Virginia, and Ohio, covering the region's economic transition. For all of our political reporting from this year's election cycle, head to our website, AlleghenyFront.org. Years ago, Pennsylvania elk were hunted into extinction. So in 1913, the state imported some of their western cousins to repopulate. Now more than 1,000 of their descendants roam north-central Pennsylvania, and they have a lot of fans, especially at this time of year. 90.5 WESA's Megan Harris brings us this story.
That is an elk, a Pennsylvania elk. One of an estimated 1,100 in a growing herd that grazes year-round across the state. But this month, they're a little busy.
This is their mating season. They're most active. They're bugling, which is their mating call. Their antlers are all shined up for the ladies, and they're sparring, which everybody wants to see. Honestly, the poor cows, nobody comes to see them. They come in June to see the babies. They come in the fall to see the bulls, and the cows are just here with them. My name is Joni Davis, and I'm a park ranger here at the Elk Country Visitor Center in Benezet, Pennsylvania. It's either called a bugle or a bark. It just kind of depends on how you refer to it. It's mostly a noise of warning. A lot of times is when they use it. Sometimes they'll let out a little noise to call their calf or whatever, but for the most part, the bulls are the ones that bugle.
Wild elk herds once ranged by the thousands from New York State to Georgia, but by the 1850s, hunters had killed them all. Early conservationists stepped in 1913 with the newly created Pennsylvania Game Commission. They brought over several dozen replacement elk from the Rockies. The program had mixed reviews. The elk were basically dumped off the trains and allowed to wander at will, Farmers complained that crops were being eaten or destroyed. They tried brief hunting seasons, but too many animals got killed. Tiny herd populations seesawed for nearly 80 years. But not anymore. Census figures estimate there were 566 elk in the year 2000. Since then, they've doubled. Safe foraging habitat, dedicated grazing lands, and highly regulated hunting are a big part of that. And some credit belongs to the state's new multi-million dollar visitor center. It sits on state land, but is managed by a nonprofit, the Keystone Elk Country Alliance.
Last year, we saw our millionth visitor come through the visitor center. It opened in 2010, so this is our sixth season.
In the fall, the facility sometimes sees 5,000 visitors or more per weekend. People want to be close to the elk.
Just be patient. You have to be patient here.
People wait in line to get inside this center. I went on a recent rainy Friday. The place had been open for 10 minutes. It was already packed.
I was one with a whole bunch of girlfriends.
We come to see the elk every year because we love wildlife. We see it every day where we live, but we don't see elk.
I'm Rachel Eckstein.
Carl Eckstein, the better half of that one. Thank you very much. First 2 hours after daylight are normally best, and the last couple hours in the evening are the best, so. There's one jubilant.
Baltimore freelancer Stuart Dane adores wildlife. He says he loves photographing the battles, the way the grass flies and their antlers clash.
Tuesday night, the one bull, which we did not think would be the winner, pushed the other bull almost 100 yards. It was just amazing.
Park ranger Joni Davis likened them to a different mammal.
I refer to them as teenagers during this time of year because they're just really not thinking, and it's kind of like, who can get the most cows, you know?
When they do fight, it usually starts with a challenge bugle. Stuart Dane, the photographer, had to whip out his phone here. There are apps you can download that pretty closely mimic the sound of real elk.
Ready?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is a challenge bugle. And this... That's what all the bulls are waiting for. That's a female who's ready.
He'd like us to note here that he was only using the app for our benefit. They're not allowed on state preserves.
You've heard these in person?
Yes. Yeah. There's many others. The younger ones chirp. There's a locator bugle when they've lost some. There's lots of different things. But for the most part, if you come here and you pay attention, you will hear all of that. You will see all of that. It's absolutely fabulous.
Mating season, in all its glory, lasts a few more weeks. In Elk County, I'm Megan Harris, reporting for 90.5 WESA's Essential Pittsburgh.
Lots of great photographs to go with those mating calls. If you've never visited the elk in Pennsylvania or you want to get a second look, they're at our website, alleghenyfront.org. Thanks for listening to this week's show. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of the Allegheny Front. I'm Kara Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds, the Laurel Foundation, the Catherine Mabus McKenna Foundation, PNC Charitable Trusts, and the Benedum Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of energy and conservation. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration between public radio stations WITF in Harrisburg and WHYY in Philadelphia, covering the Commonwealth's energy economy.